I was looking this morning to find out there's going to be a sutta class on Sunday. What sutta would I teach on Sunday afternoon? And as I was looking for one of these suttas, there was a phrase which jumped out at me, where the Buddha was saying, oh, in the very early days, he didn't really need to teach many rules or to discipline his monks. All he needed to do was to arouse mindfulness in them. And that was all that was necessary. And it was a phrase which has come up many times in the original teachings of the Buddha. And it gives a part of the understanding of this very important word, mindfulness, which is often overlooked when we talk about it in Buddhist practice or in spiritual practice. Now, you all may know that mindfulness is such a big word in Buddhism, and for many people it just means like being aware of what's happening right now. But there's also another meaning to it as well, and that is actually remembering the instructions. And I wanted to make this point quite clear this evening, because I've given so many talks sitting down here, and I've given so many lectures. Apparently there's, you know, almost like 500 or 600 of them on iPod available to you. And I sometimes counted how many lectures the Buddha gave in the suttas, and I'm catching up very fast with the amount anyway, but I must admit the quality of the Buddha is far higher. But so many talks and so many instructions you're giving, and I often sort of joke to people that even though I've been teaching you for many, many years, some of you have been coming here every Friday for 20, 25 years, and you're still not enlightened. It must be I'm a very bad teacher. Imagine if I was employed by the Department of Education to teach a class, and they had to keep taking the class year after year after year after year. They'd be telling me that I'm a very bad teacher. And indeed, as I mentioned some time ago, that the job of a teacher is to get rid of disciples, not to get more. In other words, to empower the people who listen so they know exactly what to do, how to live, how to practice, so they never need to come back again. They're free of school. So why is it that people have to keep coming back? Because many of you know exactly what to do, but what is the problem? We forget. Some of the great teachings which you've heard about, which you've read, which you've known, sometimes they're there, but we don't apply them when it really counts. And this is what the Buddha meant by establishing mindfulness, or like arousing mindfulness. It's not just like being aware, it's actually remembering the instructions. Remember what you should do. Remember all of the nice teachings which really work when you get into trouble. And of course, it's not just you gets into trouble, I get into trouble too. And I was just thinking about, you know, this thing about the bhikkhuni ordination, which is still sort of lingering. And I was thinking, well, it's a wonderful thing to be into trouble, because one of the great teachings, which, you know, you should know this, but sometimes we forget it. So we arouse mindfulness on stories like The Truckload of Dung. You know, and that was the book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. In the United States, they chose that particular story and gave that as the title of the American version of the book. And it's a powerful story, and I was remembering it today. It's a great story, because life is like this. You're sitting in your monastery, or you're sitting at home, or you're driving the car, you're in your office, and someone delivers a whole truckload of shit. And it's right in front of, if it's me, my cave door, if it's you, in front of your apartment door or your house. And there's two things about this delivery of shit in your life. And the most important thing is, you did not order it. So sometimes it's like that. I think, why me? Why does this happen to me? I didn't do anything. But then you get this big truckload of smelly shit. So life is like that. Why me, you say, because you didn't deserve it, you didn't do anything, and this thing happens to you in life, and you think, why me? That's the first thing about the truckload of dung. You didn't order it, you're not responsible for it, but no one saw it coming, so you can't ring up somebody to take it away. The second thing with the dung which arrives in your life is you're stuck with it. So sometimes that happens in life. Disappointments, tragedies, unfair things happen to you, cancers, divorces, things go wrong. No one's to blame, number one. But number two, you can't ring up a friend to get them to take it away. You're stuck with it. And a lot of times people come up and they want to sort of talk to a monk or a sister, they want to talk to a counselor. But really all the counselor can do is this, to tell them, right, here it is. No one's to blame, so don't get angry and think, why me, or blame this person, or blame that person. Because that's when we just get angry at somebody. Or we get guilty if we think we're to blame. So we're stuck with it, you can't take it away, but there's something you can do with the dung. And the counselor, the monk, or the nun, all they tell you to do is, you have all got a garden. If you haven't got a garden and you work in an apartment, or you live in an apartment, please take it to Dharmasara Monastery or Bodhinyana Monastery, or even this garden needs a bit of work every now and again. Find the nearest garden and dig it in. It takes a lot of hard work to dig in the suffering, the disappointments, the unfairness, the diseases, the tragedies of life. It's hard work digging it in, but you've got no choice. Actually, you have got a choice. Because what many people do with the dung in life, instead of digging it in, they put it in their pockets, they put it in their handbags, they shove it up their shirts and down their trousers, which means you carry it around with you. And you will find this, that if you carry around shit, you tend to lose a lot of friends. They don't like being with you much. And this particular meaning of the simile is that if you start to complain, get angry, get upset, get guilty, if you treat the difficulties of life with negativity, of course you lose friends. And unfortunately that's what many people do with the difficulties of life. They complain, they get guilty, they get angry, and they carry it around with them. But of course, I've already mentioned what you should do, dig it in your garden. If you dig it in your garden, that's hard work, and sometimes maybe just one bucket a day or half a bucket a day, but you dig it in, and after a while, we call it the miracle of Dhamma, Dhamma of truth. And that miracle is the pile of dung, the pile of shit has disappeared in front of your door. It's gone. The problem has been vanished. And in its place, you have got the most magnificent garden. And of course, we're not talking about gardens of flowers and trees and fruit. We're talking about the garden of wisdom, a garden of courage, a garden of kindness and compassion. Not just the kindness and compassion and wisdom which people get from books, but the kindness, compassion, wisdom which you get through digging in the difficulties of your life, learning from them, instead of getting negative about them, embracing them, understanding them, digging them in to your heart, to your mind, to your life. And from those experiences you get this incredible garden coming. Wisdom, kindness, compassion, this is what I call the garden of the heart. All comes because we dig it in. Now, you've heard that story before, I hope. But sometimes we forget it, don't we? Sometimes things come up in our life, we get angry, we get negative, we start blaming people, why me, this shouldn't happen to me. But if you remember this, if you arouse mindfulness, then even difficult things which happen to you in your life, tragedies, the death of a loved one, a disappointment, people treating you unfairly, you lose your job, you don't get any Christmas presents, whatever it is. I just saw outside, it was supposed to be saying season's greetings, but it got season's gettings, which is actually much more appropriate to Christmas time, because the R and E have actually fallen off. So I think we should have that outside Myers and Coles and all these other stores. Season's gettings to you all. But when we have any difficulties and tragedies, when we know what to do with these things, when we remember what to do with these things, there's no problems anymore. So it's important for us to arouse this mindfulness, to remember the Dhamma, the teachings, the advice which we've learned, and that becomes our mindfulness. And actually that is one of the reasons why you come here sort of once a week, those of you who've been here for a long time, just to get the message in your brain again, to arouse the mindfulness, to remember these things, even though that you've heard them before. Because once you remember these things again and again, it sticks in the mind, and the next time you have a difficulty or trouble, when you sort of get pinged for speeding, when you sort of go home, or when you lose your license, you know, because you've been pinged for speeding too much, you say, oh, well, that's wonderful. More dung for my garden. More wisdom. Because if you know, lose your license over the Christmas period, then you're in line with this great meeting in Copenhagen, because you can be much more environmentally friendly over Christmas once you've lost your license. You take the buses and the trains or whatever. But whatever it is, you can always make use of something as fertilizer for your life. Which means we don't get stuck in negativity, we don't get into anger, we don't get into this negativity which causes most of the pain in life. Now when we remember this, this is what we really mean by rousing mindfulness. Unfortunately, people think that mindfulness is just being aware of the moment. Or what sometimes people do in meditation retreats, when they're mindful, they start doing things very, very slowly. And I remember this conference which I went to in Vietnam some time ago, and there was one person, these conferences, they have these plenary sessions where people give talks, and then they break out sessions, and then you have little workshops, and the leader of the workshop has to come back and report to everybody what they decided in their workshop. And this was a Buddhist workshop, and when it came back to reporting, the leader of one of these workshops, she was a meditator. And so when they asked her to get up from the panel, from the bench, and walk over to the microphone, she decided to walk mindfully to the microphone. And she walked, noticing every movement of her foot as it rose up into the air, and as she moved forward until she put her foot down onto the ground. And then the next step, as she noticed the weight move from one leg to another and slightly lift up. And she took so long to walk to the microphone that her time was up. And that was a true story. It happened. It was stupid. Because mindfulness is not just going slowly. It's remembering the instructions. You've got to go fast. You've only got 15 minutes. And another person's got to come afterwards. It reminds me of another story which I heard about this meditator on one of these retreats here in Perth. They was into this very slow doing things, eating very mindfully and slow, walking slow. And they were already pretty slow before, so when they went back to their job on a Monday morning, which is in Perth Zoo, so the head keeper knew how slow they were, knew they'd just been on a meditation retreat, so even more slow. So they said, okay, for the next week you can look after the tortoises. That's quite appropriate. But this is how slow they were, that actually at lunchtime the head keeper came and checked up on the guy, and there the door was open, all the tortoises had escaped. And he said, what on earth has happened? And he said, well, I just opened the door and whoosh, they were all gone. So that's going too slow. I read that in a book, anyway. It's not a true story. So mindfulness is not just doing things slow. It's remembering what you're supposed to be doing. If it's time to go slow, then go slow. If it's time to go fast, go fast. Remember the instructions. If it's time to be wise, remember those instructions. Remember all the things you've learned, and what we should do, and how we should do it, and why we should do it. It's what Ajahn Chah used to say. It's mindfulness along with wisdom. Making sure we understand what is the right thing to do at the right time. Last week I was talking about sort of the impermanence, and sometimes it's a time to do something, and sometimes a time just to be slow, and just you can't do anything. And it's the mindfulness reminds you that you have these choices in life. I often think that mindfulness, what mindfulness really is, is giving you more options in life. Instead of just going through the same door every day, you can go through different doors. You've got more options, more choices on how to deal with tragedies, on how to deal with joys, on how to deal with whatever else comes up in your life. You have more options, and that's what mindfulness gives you, more doors to go through. And so when you have more choices, whatever is happening, say you know you've got a parent or a friend who is dying, you don't always have to go through the same choices, the same ways of doing things. I've often seen when you know someone comes up to you and they say, "Oh, you know, my mother died today," and you say, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry." "What do you mean you're terribly sorry? Your mother could have left you a fortune in their will. You could have really been upset at your mother or whatever. She may have been had a long illness and her death is a release." But why is it we always respond with the same word, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry," when you don't really know what you're talking about? So sometimes even the way we respond to particular events in life is so conditioned, we do it just one way, we don't have any choices. So certain things in our mind are sad. Why do they have to be sad? What mindfulness does, it gives you the option to look at things in a totally different way. Sometimes things are great fun and great joy. You know, it's going to be holiday soon. Whoopee! Is that good? You know, you're going to be visiting your relations soon. I remember another little joke about this person who said that his mother-in-law would come around their house every Christmas. The mother-in-law would come around their house. But this year they decided to make an exception, do something different. They decided to let the mother-in-law in the house. Well, that's why I tell a joke like that, is because sometimes people feel that way. You know, the Christmas, "Oh, I've got to put up with the mothers-in-law." If that is your attitude, maybe look at it a different way. Mindfulness says, "Well, no, I can actually make use of this in a different way. Maybe this is an opportunity. You've heard all this talk about compassion and loving-kindness meditation. I've got to face my relations this Christmas. I'm not looking forward to it. How about using this? Wow, this is an opportunity to develop loving-kindness to people who's really hard to be kind to. This is a test for me to see in the past 12 months how much my meditation and my understanding of kindness has really developed. So that when your mother-in-law comes around, you think, now she is going to be my test, my Christmas test. How kind and how compassionate and how open-hearted can I be to her?" It gives you an alternative, a different way of facing these things. And if you really want to, it's amazing that when you are mindful enough, you remember the Dharma, you don't always have to react with negativity. You don't always have to think, "I really have just to bear with this, get through it, and it'll only be for a few hours and then she's gone, or he's gone." No. Why not sort of actually make use of it as a nice test for you, just to see just how much you can use that opportunity to actually to grow. So the mindfulness tells us we have different ways of dealing with things. And then when we have those different choices, we don't always have to react in the same old way. Over the Christmas time, many people, many families have arguments, you know, because it's stressful. You know, getting all of your things ready and then getting all the house and seeing all the family, getting all the presents, getting all this together. And it's very tiring and very stressful. And a lot of times people have arguments, especially in families. And when I see that, I thought, what a shame. Can't we be a bit more mindful? Why is it that every time, you know, your husband winds you up, you always react in the same old way? You know, the bickering which people have in families. And sometimes you actually can tell how long a person's been married by the way they speak to each other. They say in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbours listen to both of them. They're arguing. But okay, that's only a joke. That's not sort of a total generalisation. But there's something truth to that, because after a while we tend to argue with each other. And I like being with people. They're both really nice people. You know, the wife, I know the husband, and they're just really good people. Why do they argue? They're just a bad habit they get into. And I don't think they've got any other choice. You know, when she calls you a dog, you call her a camel. When she calls you stupid, you call her, well, you know, you're an idiot. Why is it that people actually talk to each other in such a negative way? It's because we think we've got no choice. What mindfulness does gives you another choice. And one of those great choices you have is actually to pause and don't talk back straight away. It's the opportunity for silence. Something you learn in meditation, the power of silence. So the next time someone argues at you, shouts at you, abuses you, when they're finished, pause and be silent for maybe 30 seconds. Because in that 30 seconds, when you're not speaking, the only thing they can hear is the echo of what they've just said. They can only reflect on the harsh words which they've just spoken. And when they do that, you are teaching them, or rather, giving them the opportunity to learn just what a terrible words they've just spoken. Only if you can pause for those 30 seconds or a minute. What usually happens, though, in such conversations, when one person finishes, now it's my turn to fight back. It's just like some boxing match with words. But when we have the mindfulness enough to pause, the other person can hear what they're saying. And they realize, what a stupid thing I've just said. It's a circuit breaker in this negative communication which people have in their life. And also it gives you the chance to cool down so you don't react in negativity. But you can react in another way with some type of kindness or some sort of beautiful reaction. The mindfulness does give you those options, different ways of dealing with the problem. So by pausing, by not just acting just like a robot, the same way, the same words, criticizing each other, the mindfulness, when you remember it, it gives you different ways of dealing with the problem. And it's amazing just how you can solve these long-going problems which cause so much hurt and harm sort of in a relationship. And sometimes in that pausing, you know, when you're pausing, sometimes in that silence, all these other possibilities arise. I have often mentioned that insight and wisdom arises in silence, because in that silence, you're not just going around the ordinary ways you do things in life. You learn how to be innovative, seeing things in a different way, doing things in a different way. And sometimes that not only makes your life more interesting and more adaptable to the time and place, it also means that sometimes you come up with some very, very wise and innovative and helpful ways of dealing with these problems, simply because you pause long enough to see a wider, fuller picture. So, when we can remember these teachings, arouse that mindfulness, you're in a difficult position, you've got problems in life, there is some sort of difficulty which you're facing at work or in life, the mindfulness does give you those different options. And this is where we solve so many of the problems of life. But to be able to arouse that mindfulness, to remember these things, it's not only just, you know, coming along and filling your head with Dharma teachings, it's also having them, having the ability to put them into practice when it really counts. And you know, sometimes you think, well, maybe, you know, how do I remember these teachings? I also must say that there are times when, especially when you really are in difficulty, when these teachings, they just come up to help you. When you really, really need them, they're there for you. Because one of the monks told me that today I was busy working over in the retreat center, and a call came through from overseas, and they wanted to speak with me. And the reason they wanted to speak with me was because they said another person who wanted to say that I'd saved their life. And it was literally saving their life. I know I'm getting into big trouble these days because so many people tell me that I've saved their life. And with all the babies being born and me saving so many people's lives, I'm getting more responsible for the increase in the population on this planet. So you should let more people die so we don't have such an environmental impact on this planet. But anyway, apparently I've saved many people's lives. I'm not very popular with the funeral directors. I'm bad for their business. But this person said I saved their life because what happened to them? They had a heart attack. This was overseas somewhere. And they said they felt, this is secondhand, I might get it a little bit inaccurate, but this is the basic gist of it. They felt some very strong feelings in their chest. They lay down, and 30 minutes later they came to. And they were told for about those 30 minutes, or most of them, their heart wasn't beating at all. And the doctor can't know why they actually survived with no brain damage, no problems at all. And the person who was telling the story said they were quite clear of what happened and why they survived and why there was no damage at all. Basically 30 minutes of no heartbeat, but they're perfect. Okay, they're doing CPR for about 20 minutes when they found them, but they were survived with no problems at all. And they said because as soon as they realized they were having a heart attack, they remembered one of my talks where I said, really let go, really let go properly. And they did. So they realized they were in big trouble. And those words, they came to them, their mindfulness remembered them, and they did a very deep letting go. And when they came out afterwards, you know, being revived, they were as if nothing had happened at all. Perfectly healthy, no damage. So I mean, these teachings which you give here, they actually work. And it's not just, you know, for you. I practice these teachings as well whenever I'm in difficulty or trouble. Now, I always make sure that I remember these teachings and put them into practice no matter what I have to face in life. So much of life, you're in situations which are challenging, difficult, and some of the situations you haven't been prepared for. You're out of the so-called comfort zone of your life. And of course, when those things happen to me, because I get called to do all sorts of weird and strange things in my life, and when I have anything weird or strange to do, I always remember the mindfulness that even if you don't know what you're doing, you always know how to care. And for me, the mindfulness comes up that no matter what situation you're in, no matter what difficulty you're in, no matter what problems you might face, the one thing which I can always rely upon is like compassion. So my mindfulness tells me, well, be kind, be caring, be compassionate. And as long as you can do things like that, no matter what happens in life, you always come out sort of successful. And the problems aren't there because the compassion and the kindness is the one thing you know you can do. And it's incredibly powerful that when you remember to be kind, and remember that kindness is so important and so powerful, you find that so many solutions just appear to you, almost sort of out of nowhere. So letting go, being kind, remembering those things and putting them into practice in your life, you will always find that you succeed and the problems in your life disappear. So if you are having difficulties, you know, sort of shopping, or you are having difficulties, you know, your car breaks down. Another lady told me this who was on the retreat, that on the way back from the last retreat the Buddhist Society of West Australia did at Jhana Grove, driving back to Perth, her car broke down. She was at the side of the road, side of the freeway somewhere, and all these cars went past. No one would stop, but then eventually a car stopped, and it was a Buddhist. She said, oh, I'm so proud to be a Buddhist. The only person who stopped was another Buddhist. Now, of course, there's a little bit of compassion and kindness like that. That sort of has a huge effect on people's lives. It just has amazing sort of reward as well. I remember years ago, it was in the newspapers here in Perth. There was this young boy about this time at Christmas, maybe a month or two before, and he came across these two kids who were, well, you might say, like, you know, two school kids out of school. They were basically torturing a dog, you know, so maltreating it. And this little kid came up, very brave, and said, "No, stop doing that to that poor dog." And then the bigger kids sort of, you know, wouldn't pay any attention. And so the little kid said, "Look, if you stop mistreating that dog, I'll give you my bike." And of course it was an expensive bike, and the two bigger kids said, "Okay, deal." So they let the dog go, and the little kid gave them his bike. And when he went home, parents said, "What happened to your bike?" And he told the story, and the parents told the newspapers, and it was in the newspapers, and in a couple of days, the boy had about 6 new BMX bikes donated by members of the public, who thought what a kind boy that was, who was more concerned with the welfare of a dog than his own bike, and actually had an act of compassion. And there's a wonderful little story there, because whenever you are kind, you always get so much back in return. So that mindfulness there of being kind, being generous, letting people in when you're in the traffic and they want to change lanes or they want to turn left or turn right, little things like that actually work for you. We call it good karma in Buddhism, but you don't have to give it a name. You know that it works. A little bit of kindness makes life very, very beautiful. So the mindfulness says we remember those instructions to see how much we can be kind, be forgiving, give people the benefit of the doubt, give your wife the benefit of the doubt, your children, your husband, your parents the benefit of the doubt. Don't be so judgmental and critical over this time. These are basic Buddhist teachings, but sometimes we forget them. Now, one thing with learning how to remember these things is that there is a way of remembering how to be mindful in the most important situations of one's life or the most difficult situations in the life, because we all have idiosyncrasies or problems and difficulties which, you know, are really important. It may be just the way you're speaking to your partner. It may be just how you deal with a boss at work who could be a bully. It may be just how you deal with your own health problems. And now, in the meditation retreats, I developed like a simile for arousing mindfulness on the most important parts of your life using what I call the simile of the snake. I usually teach this in retreats, but very rarely do I teach it here. So this is why I wanted to share it with many people who never come on meditation retreats. The simile of the snake goes like this. It's from my time when I was a young monk in Thailand, living in these jungle monasteries where there were snakes all over the place. And I remember from that time that there were some very dangerous, venomous snakes. When I first went to Thailand, I was told, you know, there was 100 species of snakes in this forest. 99 of those 100 species are venomous. If they bite you, you're in big trouble. And the other one, the number 100 species, strangles you to death. In other words, they're all very, very dangerous. And they were dangerous, and they were all over the place. There are many, many more snakes than you see here in Australia, and all very dangerous. Now, the problem was, you knew the snakes were out there, but at night time, when we went to sort of the hall for meditation and a talk, when we went back from the hall to where we lived in our huts, it was through the jungle on these little paths, and very often I didn't have any batteries for my flashlight. You couldn't use it because the monastery was so poor we didn't have batteries. Worse, I didn't even have shoes. Because, you know, when the shoes wore out, you tried to repair them. There wasn't any shoes. It was a very poor monastery 35 years ago. So there, after the evening meeting, you had to walk back in the dark with no shoes and no flashlight, knowing there were hundreds of snakes around waiting for your feet as their dinner. That was really quite dangerous. But what I did, which obviously you can understand what you did, when I went back, because I had no flashlight and no shoes, I was really careful. And I was really on the lookout. I wasn't sort of whistling a happy song. I wasn't sort of thinking about sort of, you know, dinner tomorrow. All you were thinking about is what was in front of you. And if ever I saw like a dark shape over the path, I would jump over it. You know, there was, you know, a bit of starlight, which is what you use. You wait for your eyes to accommodate to the sort of the low light, or maybe a half moon or something. That's how you got back. If you saw a dark shape, it could be a shadow of a tree, it could be a snake, you didn't know. So you jump over it or you go by another path. And because I was always on the lookout for it, those snakes never got me, never bit me. And I used that in my life for problems or difficulties which face me in the future. As if you're like going on a path in life, and you know there's something out there which might hurt you, which might bite you. It might be just, you know, your boss at work. It might be just the way you speak to your partner. It might be some other idiosyncrasy which you have in life, like anxiety attacks or depression or nervousness. You know that's been a problem for you in the past. You know it's caused you so much difficulty and maybe failure. So you know it's like a snake waiting in the path ahead of you to cause you a lot of suffering. Now once you're on the lookout for that, in other words, you establish some mindfulness that this is a danger, I have to avoid this, then what it means is you're always on the lookout and you usually see it before it causes you trouble, before it bites you or wraps its coils around you. Use this for things like anxiety attacks. Because anxiety attacks, if you are mindful, if you're on the lookout for them, you can actually see their causes arising, you can see the symptoms coming up, you can actually catch them before they catch you. I remember one of our fellow monks, he used this because he was a soldier in the Vietnam War. He got shot in the back of the head. He had epileptic fits because of the wound in the back of his brain. And he said he totally overcame those epileptic fits by learning or having mindfulness enough, looking out for them. So he would catch them earlier and earlier and earlier because he was on the lookout for them. That was his big snake. And he could catch them so early, he could take another course, another path, and basically prevent them from coming up. By catching them earlier, by being on the lookout for them, he could take another direction so they would never actually get him. And it's exactly the same with anxiety disorders. With fear, with nervousness, you can actually see it coming up when you're on the lookout for it. When you establish mindfulness, that's the big danger, that's my problem, it's caused lots of trouble before, I'm going to be on the lookout for it, and you can catch it early. And the trick is, once you catch it early, mindfulness gives you other options. There are other paths to follow. You don't have to go down that same path which causes a problem. With anxiety, basically you get anxious about being anxious, you get tensed up, you can do many, many other things if you start to see anxiety coming up. And one of the best ways, which is a very powerful way, if you have anxiety coming up, you can feel it in the body, you can feel maybe your stomach starting to tighten up, get your hand and massage it. Instead of actually getting afraid, do something about it, because with massage there's a kindness, a relaxation happens to that part of the body, and when the physical manifestation of anxiety disappears, so does the emotional part as well. And I've used that to great effect many, many times. If it's nervousness, how does nervousness feel in the body? Just like going for an interview, sort of going for a doctor's appointment when your biopsy results are going to come through. When there's any nervousness comes up, how do you deal with that? You find it somewhere in the body, catch it early. If you catch it early, you can always do something about it. It's like the difference between stopping a truck when it's going 110 kilometers an hour down the Kwinana Freeway and stopping a truck when it's just pulling out from the side of the road. When it's got not much momentum, it's easy to put on the brakes and stop things, even if they're very heavy. But once they're really going, it's very difficult to stop these things. So mindfulness catches these things early. It sees the snake at a distance before it's so close it's got you. So that degree of mindfulness, arousing the mindfulness awareness with the simile of the snake, means you can actually avoid many of these problems. And that is why that even in psychology now, you have mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. That's this word, but what I'm teaching you here this evening is exactly the same. The only difference is what I've taught you this evening doesn't cost anything. If you go to sort of a therapist, it costs you a huge amount of money, but it actually works, what I'm talking about here. I'm undercutting the market again. But never mind. When you actually see any problem, it may be sort of anxiety, it may be nervousness, it may be things like grief, when you sort of you remember the death of a loved one. Really, if you catch that one early, if you've seen it happening so many times, you can actually catch it early, you can start to see the symptoms coming up. You know, you're just going to get into a grief episode. See it coming up early, that's a big snake, be on the lookout for it, you can catch it early, and you can take a different path. You have alternatives. You don't have to go through that same rut of emotional reactions which has caused you so much difficulty and has disabled you from actually participating and being successful in life. You can take a different course. But if you catch it earlier, that gives you the opportunity. And about what you do, you know, I've said many times, the simile of the concert, the simile of falling leaves when someone dies who's very young. There's so many sort of ways of dealing with these things, but sometimes we forget them. And the simile of what I'm talking about today of arousing mindfulness is actually remembering all those things and putting them into practice in time that you don't have all the suffering. So whenever there's a problem in life, catch it early. And when you catch it early, now use some of these different ways of dealing with life. You've got like the disappointments in life. Maybe, you know, that you have a contract at work and you don't get it, or you don't get the rise, the promotion, or you even sort of get sacked or made redundant or whatever else happens. You know, catch that early. This is what happens in life. So, you know, catching it early, remember, so what? So what if you get sacked, if you lose, if you get redundant, or whatever else happens in life? There's so many things which you can do. So catch it early and give yourself more options. So again, if you get sacked from work, you can spend more time at Dhammasava Monastery or Bodhinyana Monastery. There's so many things you can do at home. And actually that's why that sometimes we have our retreats, especially in the holiday times, are very, very popular. Many people want to book up to come down to our monasteries over the Christmas period. And when I asked them today, they told me that it's because if they stay at home, their wife only tells them to fix this and fix that, so they don't get much of a holiday anyway, so they might as well come down to the monastery. And it's much more peaceful down there. I think a few people are smiling because I think you know what I mean. So, there's always different ways of dealing with these things which happen in life, and the mindfulness catches it early and gives you the opportunities actually to take different courses in life. So arousing mindfulness helps you. And if the simile of the snake doesn't work, the next simile is also highly effective. It's what I call programming your mindfulness. So this is where you have like a problem, you're always get angry at the people you work with, or you don't treat them properly, you really want to change your ways, but you find you can't do it. So what you do is when you are in a comfortable position, relaxed at home, whatever time of your day you feel the most relaxed, the most at ease, that's the time to do what we call programming your mindfulness. When all that really means, it's like a self-hypnosis, it's auto-suggestion. Give yourself some instructions of what you want to do. Like an example, someone who's an alcoholic, and you know, whenever they see some alcohol, they can't stop themselves. It's just a habit. So what they say to themselves, in the calmness, quietness, in the calm, quiet part of their day, I will not pick up that glass of alcohol. I will not pick up that glass of alcohol. I will not pick up that glass of alcohol. to repeat it themselves 3 times, a simple instruction, repeat it. Because it's the nature of the mind is that when you give simple instructions, repeated, paying attention, it actually gets stored inside. And once it gets stored inside, you don't need to do anything anymore. It's stored inside there. And so a person may be at a party and say, you know, have a glass of beer, and they're about to take that, and sometimes they're not even mindful enough, usually, that the beer's down their throat before they realize what they've done. But because you program the mindfulness, you're about to take that beer, the old habit is about to come up, the mindfulness stops you. Because you remember, I will not pick up that beer. Someone trying to give up smoking, again, it works wonderfully well. Now, when you feel relaxed and calm, tell yourself, I won't pick up that first cigarette, I won't pick up that first cigarette, I won't pick up that first cigarette. Repeat it to yourself. It has to be very clear instructions. So, you know, your mind's not going to get confused. And then the habit of just picking up the cigarette and putting it in your mouth and lighting it without really thinking is stopped. You're about to do that and it just, the thought comes up into your mind. It's an automatic because you programmed it. It's like an antivirus. As soon as the problem arises, so the thought comes up and you can actually stop it. So when that happens, you realize you can actually arouse mindfulness by programming it into your day. If it's a difficult person at work and you have an idea of how you want to deal with that person, before you go to work early in the morning, program your mindfulness. You know, when I see that person, I'll be kind to them. When I see that person, I'll be kind to them. When I see that person, I'll be kind to them. And the next time you see that person, instead of reacting in a habitual fashion of being afraid of them or being angry at them, you'll find it just comes out. You're kind to them. And why are you kind? Because you programmed yourself early in the morning. And this is actually a way of using mindfulness, using the power of the mind. When you give it instructions, it remembers them subconsciously and it puts them into practice at that time when you programmed to put it into practice. When you employ that and exploit that, it does actually solve a lot of problems in your day. So, whatever any difficulties you have in your life, by arousing that mindfulness, understanding what it is, it's not just like being aware of this moment, it's actually giving yourself good instructions and learning how to remember those instructions. You know, little things that you may be very busy in work, and you know you're stressing out, and you've heard that, you know, when you do stress out, the best thing to do is give yourself a minute or two of relaxation. But you keep on doing that year after year and getting yourself more and more sick, and all the instructions, you should take a break, you should relax, you're not doing it. Why? Because you haven't really programmed your mindfulness enough. So, you know, if you have a lot of stress at home or at work especially, you know, when you're relaxed, remind yourself that's a problem, that's like a snake on the path in your life, it's going to kill you. So, or program your mindfulness. When I really feel that stress, when I really feel tired, when my brain feels really stuffed up, this is what I'll do. I'll go take toilet break and meditate on the toilet. At least they leave you alone in there. Or I can actually just sit in my office like that friend does. Every hour on the hour, he closes his eyes and meditates for 1 minute in his office. When people pass him by, they think he's just thinking about the next contract. Because when your eyes are closed, no one knows what you're doing inside. But he's actually watching his breath, he's being in the moment, he's meditating for 1 minute every hour on the hour. So actually, I've told all you now if you see your, you know, one of your workers, every hour on the hour they've got their eyes closed, you know where they got this from. They're not thinking about the next business deal, they're actually meditating. But he does that because he realizes that taking 1 minute of break means the next 59 minutes his brain is efficient, he gets more work done. And so you always know that, you know, that lessening your stress gets more work done and higher quality of work, but our problem is we forget to take those breaks and we just stress ourselves out and screw ourselves up, making ourselves unhealthy and also very grumpy and angry at people because we don't have any sort of sense of peace inside our mind. We're just so tired. So program your mindfulness. And when you go to work in the morning, or even before you even get out of bed, say, today when I get tired, I'll take a rest. Today when I get tired, I'll take a rest. Today when I get tired, I'll take a rest. And if you put that into your brain in the early morning, when you're working throughout the day, when you do feel tired, that thought will come up. I feel tired, I'll take a break. Because you've actually programmed that information in, that instruction in the early morning, and you find it works really well. You are remembering the instructions when it really matters to you. So you can take a break. You all know it works. You take a break for a couple of minutes and you make up that time afterwards, you feel much better. You all know the instructions, you know, you've heard them so many times. It's actually putting them into practice, and this is how we do it. So that way you find that you can avoid many of the pitfalls and difficulties which you face in your daily life. So the mindfulness, which is a core teaching of Buddhism, is not just being aware, it's also remembering the instructions of life. All the great words you've heard, the great teachings you have accumulated in your life, you've all got the information there, you've got the wisdom there, but sometimes we just don't put it into practice. We forget. So by practicing that type of mindfulness, you find that much of your life goes far, far more smoothly. And as it goes more smoothly, now the ability to remember, the ability to keep these things in mind, gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And so when people do upset you, now you remember, why should I allow other people to control my happiness? You can do what you like, you can say what you like, but my happiness is my concern. It makes a lot of sense, I've said that many times before, never allow other people, not even allow life to control your happiness. But we keep forgetting that. So we remember that, the more we actually practice these ways, the more free we are in life, the more of these teachings we remember. And so this actual path of increasing your mindfulness, it's not just a practical path to get through life's suffering, life's difficulties, and have an easier life. As you have an easier life with less problems, because it's not taking up so much energy of your mind becomes more powerful, and the mindfulness becomes more easy to see the right strategies to use in every moment of your life. It remembers more things because your mind is more energized and powerful because you're not having so much difficulties in life. So the difficulties you're left with gets less and less and less, and it's like a snowball effect happens with mindfulness. Once you get it going and you're more free from the problems of life, the more time you have to be see the lesser problems of life, and those start to disappear. And as you practice this path of awareness and remembering the instructions of mindfulness and wisdom, just basically your life gets freer and freer and freer. Which means that just the difficulties in life just don't affect you. So no matter what happens, any problems which would really shake other people, any tragedies which would make a person just cry or scream, all those things don't affect you. It's like I saw in the newspapers, there was a movie, and the movie was called The Bulletproof Monk. And I understand what a bulletproof monk really means. It doesn't mean that someone can shoot him with a sort of machine gun and the bullets don't get into him. A bulletproof monk means whether it's somebody dies in your family, when it's a great disappointment, when you lose things you really cherish and you really love, when everything goes wrong, all those bullets of malicious words, the bullets of undeserved suffering, the bullets of life, they don't affect you. And that's what we really mean by a bulletproof nun and a bulletproof monk. Whatever happens in life, happiness, suffering, gain and loss, pain or misfortune and fortune, all those things, they don't affect you. And that's what we call a bulletproof monk, a bulletproof nun, a bulletproof man, a bulletproof woman. And why does this come from? By the establishment of mindfulness, the awareness and the strategies which you learn. So you look at life and you practice life, you live life in a wise way until the bullets of life cannot penetrate you. Whatever happens in life, it doesn't control your happiness. It doesn't control your peace. You become another one of the liberated ones. So that's what we mean by mindfulness, and establishing mindfulness, remembering the instructions, having strategies, so all these things in life no longer affect you. You become the bulletproof member of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Thank you for listening. Very good. So now, any comments or questions about this evening's talk about the arousing of mindfulness to become the bulletproof member? Yes?
Adam, you said that when we are violent to ourselves and other people in subtle ways or a gross way, if you have a mental picture frame around the situation of we just don't have any other choice.
Don't have any other choice except to be.
A bit more about that, please,
Yeah. Okay, this is a sense of when you're in difficult situations and you respond with violence, either verbal violence or physical violence. And again, I think many sort of psychologists and neuropsychologists, sometimes they say that that was the behavior one learned as a child, and one is revisiting the abuse which one had when one was young, in the present moment, on whoever happens to be the bystander. In one sense, that you can understand why, because the condition you had as a young person is limiting your choices. You think that's the only way to deal with a problem. What mindfulness does, again, gives you other opportunities, other ways of dealing with that problem. I think you know that one of the stories which comes to mind, my own father, who was abused terribly as a child by his father, my paternal grandfather in London, who was very poor, a drunkard, in the Depression years in the United Kingdom in the 1930s, would come home every evening from work, drunk, get out his belt and whip any kid in his path, including my father, and then start beating his wife, my father's mother. I remember my father once telling me, he said when he was on the end of that belt, for no reason at all, he said that he made a resolution. He said, whenever I have kids, I will not punish them this way. And that was his programming of his mindfulness. He was responding to abuse in another way. And the reason I tell that story is there is an alternative. When you're being abused, you understand how much suffering it creates. And you use that insight, that understanding, to arouse compassion. You've had the shit, you've dug it in, and you're not going to cause abuse to other people. And so my father would never use corporal punishment. Because he knew what it was like. He said, there's other ways of dealing with that. And of course he was a very great father, and he didn't need to use corporal punishment. So you understand why? There are alternatives. And it's part of the job of either myself or a counsellor, giving those alternatives. You can give those alternatives as much as you like, but a person has to remember them. And the thrust of the talk this evening, because you've heard from myself, from other monks, from other nuns, from other teachers, huge number of alternative ways of dealing with the problems of life. But why don't we put them into practice? I'm giving some hints on how we can use the wisdom we all possess to give ourselves alternatives to such things as acting with violence to people who are violent at us. It's so important because just using harsh words on the people you love, it doesn't really work. There has to be an alternative. You know, using violence, you know, to people who have different ideas than us or use violence against us. Again, it's not working. You go to war against people to defend your country. And where does that leave us? Is that really going to sort of solve the problem? How many wars do we have to have? So we have to find alternatives. You know, we know we have to find alternatives. There are alternatives around, but often we forget. So it's a forgetfulness which is one of the biggest problems. Does that sort of answer your question, sort of? That's right, yes, but it's true that sometimes violence has a certain pleasure about it, and you've got to admit that. That's why people like watching violent movies. There's a certain pleasure about it, but there's also a great cost, as you say, to that violence. And it's actually when a person is mindful, not just of the immediate sort of boost of pleasure and sense of power, but also remembers the cost of that violence, they keep that in mind as well, then when you do the cost-benefit analysis, it usually is never worthwhile. The thing is, it's afterwards one realizes that. Afterwards one realizes, why did I do this? It wasn't really worthwhile. So at the time, it's a bit too late. You have to put that instruction in, do that cost-benefit analysis of, you know, what you've learned so far, and program that into your mindfulness. Yeah, I know it's going to feel good, but it's going to cost too much. I know it's going to feel good, but it's going to cost too much. I know it's going to feel good, but it's going to cost too much. And so when you're in that situation, you'd usually go the path of violence. The thought comes up. You remember, it's going to cost. Yeah, I want to do this, but it's going to cost. You stop. That programming stops you. It's remembering the instructions. And then you don't do these, what is basically unmindfulness, bad habits. We all got our bad habits, we keep forgetting, that's a problem. Okay, very good. Another satisfied customer. So, any more questions before we finish off today? Yeah, okay. Yes.
I read about it, and the recommendation in the literature I read was to avoid negative instructions to the mind, because the mind, being a little bit stupid, would remember, for example, the example you gave, I will not pick up that glass of alcohol. I will not would be forgotten, and pick up the alcohol would be remembered. So it is recommended that in that case,
okay, yeah.
Do you have an opinion about it, and do you think it matters?
Okay, you're saying that if you do give instructions to mindfulness, like keep it positive rather than keeping it negative, because there's a bit too much negativity. And it is true, I take on board what you say, that if you can turn the instruction into something more positive, instead of not doing this and not doing that and not doing this and not doing that, sometimes we get so much of that, it sometimes impinges on our sense of freedom and personal power and personal responsibility, and sometimes we do it just because we're told we're not to. And I know there's many people like that. So when they say don't walk on the grass, that's an invitation to say, well, if you're going to put that, I'm going to walk on the grass. So sometimes, but sometimes some negativity is sometimes really helpful. A good example is, I just was passing our retreat center today, and you know, we try and keep it quiet, so we had to put a sign up. And the sign is usually, trespassers will be prosecuted. But if you ever go past Jhana Grove, you see that's not the sign we have up there. The sign we have is, trespassers will be converted, which is far more effective, because not many people think they'll be prosecuted, but they're really scared shitless they might be converted if they enter a Buddhist monastery. So that keeps people away. So give instructions, but give instructions which can be positive or amusing. And I think you've got a good point there. But sometimes the no's are also important, as well as the, you know, please do this. Yeah, okay, I agree with you there that sometimes a more positive one can be very useful, a more positive way of giving the same instruction, but sometimes sort of a no is also important, a stop. Yeah, it gives fear, but sometimes the fear of snakes is actually quite helpful, and the fear of bushfires is quite helpful. So there are like positive fears, as long as one doesn't get sort of paranoid. So, but I take on board your statement. If it can turn it into a positive way, it can be more effective.